Welcome to Between Two Rounds. I'm Tariq Wakid, founding partner at Type 1 Ventures. I'm here with Robert Carlisle, CEO and co-founder of Argo Space and formerly at SpaceX. Today we'll just be having a casual conversation talking about the space industry, generally space, generally tech, and life. So welcome and join us. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi, Tariq. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, good. How's your week been?
Pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've known you for a while now. Mm-hmm. When I first met you, you were at SpaceX.
Yep.
And I think a year after we met, you reached out to me and you said, hey, I've left SpaceX and I think I want to start a new company.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't care what it is. And here's some money. Tell us a little about yourself, how you got into the space industry. I know, like myself, you are from the Southeast.
Yep.
And, made your way into government and the space industry. And now running your own company with your three brothers. And one of your brothers is named after a Pokemon.
Yes, Kirby and Ryan, my brothers, are the co-founders.
Kirby's a Pokemon?
Kirby, he's not a Pokemon, but, you know, the pink puffball, he kind of looks like the
Super Smash Pokemon. Brothers. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Mostly grew up in Atlanta, although Ryan and I were born in Texas, so that blood is important, differentiated from the Southeast. You know, Ryan and I being born in Houston, you know, growing up visiting the Johnson Space Center as kids, that was one of the initial sparks that led us to this love of the space industry and, you know, always wanting to be in this business.
Do you have a memory of when you were a child, when space really, like, was a thing that became, like, any moment?
Yeah, I think it was just sort of always a thing. You know, I was one of those kids who had solar system posters and did Estes rockets with my parents and did space Legos and all of that from a young age. So, you know, definitely it was when I grew up, I'm going to be an astronaut situation. Didn't quite make that, but still in the business.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet. Not yet.
That's really cool to see. And when did you decide you were going to join SpaceX?
So, when I went to college to do aerospace engineering, when I did that, you know, I was thinking I would go into defense, work on aircraft, missiles, that kind of thing. And I did end up doing that after college. Was a real engineer for a while, worked on a missile defense program, but always had this pull to get back to space. So I had a variety of real normal jobs post-college. And then at that time, for me, really the cool space business was actually Virgin Galactic. So they had won the XPRIZE.
What time was this?
2004 or 2005 timeframe. And, you know, I thought the promise of human spaceflight, you know, rapid reuse space tourism was big. And that was going to be the thing, right? That hasn't quite panned out yet.
It's getting there.
It is getting there. And SpaceX really took up the mantle of commercial spaceflight. So that was super exciting. And eventually found my way back to SpaceX in 2017.
Okay.
So I joined on the government sales side.
Okay.
Basically selling launch services to national security customers. Had a few different jobs at SpaceX, worked on their satellite programs when they were getting started on the defense side, and then did a little bit of sort of the bread and butter, you know, commercial launch sales, just getting customer satellites out to space.
That's awesome. Yeah, I met you on the sales side, so that was really cool to see. And it's really interesting to see how there's so much SpaceX has brought people that are outside the space industry and allowed them to be in the space industry mm-hmm. through their massive workforce they have. But also the culture that's built at SpaceX is now spinning out. People spend time there and then leave and then say, this is possible for me to do on my own. When I was growing up, I also wanted to be an astronaut, but there was at that time maybe 10, 20 people chosen every decade to go to space. Mm-hmm. And so you had to be exceptional. And I'm not that exceptional to be chosen and be like a doctor and a Navy SEAL and whatever to get chosen as an astronaut. And now it's becoming more mainstream, I guess you could say. And I love seeing how there's so many people thinking about what's next. We're launching to space. We can get there. Rapid reusable access to space is becoming a thing.
Yep.
What now? How do we benefit Earth? How do we, you know, start going to the moon? And, you know, so maybe tell us a little bit about how the ideation of the company you're working on now came to be.
Sure, yeah. I do think, you know, outside of the space industry, SpaceX did help bring space transportation, space travel back into sort of mainstream, at least American public consciousness. You know, when they launched the first astronaut mission, when SpaceX launched their first astronaut mission with Bob and Doug in the middle of COVID, that was kind of a big national moment.
That was a big deal, yeah.
You know, I watched that with my wife, who otherwise doesn't care about space, but everyone was excited.
What were the social distancing rules in the Falcon 9 at that time? Is
there any? There were not any inside the Dragon capsule.
Okay. They had the quarantine.
But they were quarantined before, as astronauts do before the mission. Yeah.
Oh, man. Quarantine was such a difficult thing.
Yes.
Like, I was quarantined in a hotel room for 14 days. I think I went insane. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't changed.
Yeah. A lot of that for everybody at that time.
Yeah. So, tell me more about, like, how you came to the idea of Argo.
Yeah. So, I think, you know, Ryan and Kirby and I always wanted to do some kind of space business. We were all three at SpaceX together. They were both on the engineering side, and I was on the business side. But we eventually came to this idea based on, you know, some things that we were seeing within SpaceX, how SpaceX was doing their Starlink missions, right, and really making that look like a normal, you know, high-rate transportation service. For their own purposes, you know, SpaceX is launching these Starlink missions multiple times a week.
Sometimes multiple times a day.
Sometimes multiple times a day. Yeah. A really unprecedented cadence for space, but very normal if you look at terrestrial logistics, right? Just this cargo delivery mm-hmm. to a standard orbit, very mm-hmm. high rate, very high reliability, very low cost. And that's just a fundamental difference from the sort of bespoke, risky, expensive way we've thought about space transportation before. Rocket launches are like this exciting, big thing. You know, people tune in to watch them. SpaceX has been changing that with Starlink launches.
So to put it into context, or for those of us that aren't so understanding of the economics of how it used to work, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you were to build a satellite, you had maybe one launch attempt a year, mm-hmm. And it was multi-billion-dollar launch because the rocket wasn't reusable.
Yep.
So whatever you're putting in there, if you're a company, you have to make sure all of those, every part, every nut and bolt is space rated and isn't off the shelf. Yep. And so each nut and bolt would cost a lot. So then the cost of the satellite would go up.
Right.
And now, because you have a launch attempt every week and it's cheaper, you can use off-the-shelf parts, so you can get a satellite or an MVP up to space for mm-hmm. a fraction of that cost.
Right.
And that's changing the economics for people like you that are starting to build companies around not just getting to space, but what do you do when you're up there? Is that
right.
correct?
Yeah, and really for us, part of it is how do we bring this sort of SpaceX-style, Starlink-style logistical transportation, high-rate transportation to everyone else. Mm. If you go beyond SpaceX's internal use to, you know, normal external customer launches, look at what Viasat or EchoStar or IntelSat, anyone else is doing, it still looks like a more traditional launch, right?
In what way?
You've got a very big, custom, expensive satellite.
Okay.
It's being contracted, you know, 2+ years in advance. There's a lot of custom engineering work, a lot of testing and integration between the satellite and the rocket. It's still pretty bespoke.
Okay.
So that process, I think, is what we can help with and change the industry so that everyone else can take advantage of those sort of low cost, high rate LEO launches mm-hmm. that SpaceX is doing. So our part of our idea is creating multimodal logistics for space, right? Having the rockets act like cargo ships, not just for Starlink, but for every type of satellite and other payloads, and then build these trucks for space
that
transport things everywhere else.
Nice. So essentially how I understand, because I've spent some time with you, and when we've invested in your company, is SpaceX can get you to LEO, so low Earth orbit. And from LEO, your company picks up the satellite and moves it to a different location mm-hmm. because SpaceX won't take you, if you're on a rideshare, there's 10 or 20 other satellites on that. They drop you off at the Greyhound station and then your Uber picks you up and moves you to wherever you need to do your business.
Right, right.
But then you have another piece of your business that is mm-hmm. Has to do with the moon.
Yes.
So tell us about that and why that makes your transportation business so much more important.
Yeah. So step one is sort of separating the transportation to space from the transportation in space, decoupling this, creating true logistics. Step two is using propellant sourced in space for the transportation that's happening in space.
Now we're talking.
Yeah. So fundamentally, what we're trying to do in the long term is not just transportation business, but really catalyze and create a commercial lunar economy.
Okay.
So the moon actually has water ice.
So the moon is wet.
wet, certainly not in terrestrial terms, but some water is there and we think we can get it.
Okay.
Now, why would we want to do that, right?
That's some high quality H2O.
Yes. So the moon has a sixth the gravity of Earth's. That means you can launch things off of the surface of the moon energetically much cheaper than you can launch them from Earth.
Okay, so let's drill down there. So because the moon has less gravity, mm-hmm. how does that change the rocket equation? How does that change the economics of launch?
Yep. So for us, we think that the best way to use lunar resources is to take this water and use it as propellant.
Moon has water. We grab the water.
Yep.
We're on the moon. What happens?
Yeah.
We're
basically going to use it as fuel.
Okay.
So we want to bring it back to Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, geosynchronous orbit. Low Earth orbit is the closest to Earth, right? So even there, bringing propellant from the moon to low Earth orbit gives you about a 10x advantage in the amount of propellant you can deliver compared to launching it from the surface of the Earth.
So it's cheaper and better to bring the water from, even after you have to excavate it on the moon, than to bring it from Earth.
Right.
Because of the gravity.
Yes. Now you got to figure out a way to extract it from the moon, from the lunar soil, what we call regolith, right? You have to figure out a way to get it out economically.
Okay.
We think we have done that.
Okay.
We have figured out a way to do that. But once you do that, the physics is very much in your favor.
Yeah, because there's less gravity, so you need less fuel to get off the moon. So then your rocket has more payload on that you can bring, more useful payload. I think it's like, 2% of the rocket is actual payload coming from Earth?
Yeah. When you launch a rocket from Earth, most of what you're launching is just fuel, right? Propellant.
Yeah.
We want to say, all right, let's just launch the rockets to low Earth orbit. Don't be launching more and more fuel to get them out to, GEO, MEO, cislunar space. Let's use the rockets only for what they need to do, which is get to orbital velocity, and then use this lunar propellant and in-space transportation, space trucks, to move things everywhere else.
And once you've started to mine water on the moon, what are other uses for lunar water in the long term?
Yeah. So propellant is, we think, the catalyst and sort of the industrial baseline, right? But then there's human use of water. NASA is looking at this already for the Artemis program. The mission planning often focuses around the south pole of the moon where water ice exists in higher concentrations, we think. Mm-hmm. So people need water to drink. They need it to live. They need it to operate. Then if we actually get to a point where people are living and operating in space, whether in orbit or
a space station,
on the moon, whatever, you have industrial uses of water. You can use it for different types of propellant. So there's ways that we use it ourselves to provide transportation, but other people can use it as hydrolox. So, for example, that's what Blue Origin does. Hydrogen, liquid oxygen, those can make rocket fuel. So it can be sort of the working fluid and the fuel for all of our operations through the solar system.
So kind of like oil.
Yes, yes, the oil of space.
Well, I'm an Arab, so we love that. I'm actually, some people would consider me not an Arab because I'm Lebanese. And so Lebanese are like kind of their own thing. Well, it depends. But I like oil.
Yes.
And so that's really cool. What do you think, realistically, the lunar economy looks like in terms of timing?
Yeah.
Do we have humans on the lunar surface? Let's not talk Mars yet. Mm-hmm. But do we have humans on the lunar surface in the next year, 5 years? When does it become more commercial and not just Artemis and government?
Right. I think we do have humans on the surface of the moon in the next 5 years for sure.
For
sure. The Artemis program.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that necessarily means there's a lunar economy, right? I make a distinction between getting NASA contracts, getting government contracts, and an actual economy. So if we're talking about creating an economy, actually opening the lunar frontier, that needs commercial incentives, commercial uses.
Okay.
And so that's why we're so focused on using this water as a fuel for transportation.
Yeah, because there's already satellites in low Earth orbit that need to move around without the government, because you use it for, you know, your internet on your airplane or imaging or what have you. Those satellites have a use case, a business case commercially on Earth to the general consumer. And so those satellites need to move. You can provide that movement, and you can draw lunar water to provide a commercial use case. But you're saying you need to have some customer need water on the moon commercially, not just government funded, for there to be a lunar economy. Am I correct?
Yeah. So we think we can start it even before we get to that point.
Okay.
And say, let's serve Earth-facing use cases. So like you said, companies who are today putting satellites in orbit, you know, various orbits from LEO out to geosynchronous orbit, they have terrestrial commercial use cases for internet, for video, for Earth observation, et cetera. If we can create demand for lunar water with those Earth-facing use cases, then we start to create commercial pull for a lunar resource. We start to create a lunar economy.
Okay.
And then that can incentivize more and more infrastructure and operations on the moon to serve that resource extraction.
Interesting. Now, I think there's also an interesting thing we could do. You know how SpaceX does like the tequila and all the collectibles? Argo, when you have your lunar water, you should bring some water back to Earth and make like a collectible lunar water. That would be really cool. I'd buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be pricey. But
you ever watch like the Water Boy?
Yep.
With Adam Sandler?
Of course.
Where he has that like special vial of water that like revives him. He goes, ooh, that's some high quality H2O.
That'll be our lunar water vial.
Yes, exactly. And then you just, there could be some marketing around that.
Yeah.
Or you could put like a drop of water in the diluted anyway.
Yeah. Make some nice lunar bourbon with that.
Ooh, that's a very southern thing to say. What do you think is the timeline for 100 people continuously on the lunar surface? When do you think the timeline is for things that are commercial, like touristic hotels on the moon, people going back and forth? That's really going to depend on SpaceX, but what do you think, or Blue Origin, but what do you think that is?
Yeah, 100 people, kind of hard to say. You know, in our case, most of our operations on the moon will be robotic. So we're driving sort of industrial presence, industrial use. Obviously, Artemis will be the first human presence on the moon. That's, you know, single-digit astronauts. I do think we will eventually get to, you know, at least Antarctica levels of people operating on the moon.
Like that.
And I would say that's maybe 10 years out from now.
10 years out, okay.
But we're trying to create a real durable commercial presence before that,
of course. No, I got that. I'm just kind of thinking to myself, when will I be able to go to the moon? what do you think that's dependent on? That, do you think the cost of launch will come down dramatically where it's accessible to the everyday, you know, middle class, high middle class, high net worth individual?
Eventually, I think that part is quite a long ways out. I do think launch costs will continue to come down significantly over the next 10 years. The getting humans to the moon is still very expensive. You know, that's definitely
hard.
Hard space things to do, which is why NASA is spending a lot of money on that with SpaceX and Blue Origin and others. But I think we will eventually get there, right? I think probably we'll have, you know, more low Earth orbit space stations and that kind of space tourism before we get to the moon part.
But conceivably, if you're sending 1 million people to Mars by 2050, right? That's like the public stated goal. Yeah. There will be people on the moon as well before that? Or is that all?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and part of it is just using the moon as a training ground, a proving ground for those Mars operations. But I think that's, you know, 10, 15 years away for that scale of people on the moon.
10, 15 years is not that long.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. 10 years goes by fast, especially the older you get. So tell me a little bit about your brothers and how it's like working with your brothers that you grew up with all your life.
Sure.
And it's funny that the oldest brother is, you know, kind of in like managerial CEO. The middle brother is the CTO. And then Kirby, I never know how to describe Kirby. He's kind of like a both parts.
Yes.
You know? So tell us a little bit about that. That's super interesting that you get to work with family.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well for the three of us. You know, we all did engineering undergrad and then went into engineering jobs. Ryan and Kirby were in different engineering organizations at SpaceX. And
Kirby's definitely the more fun one. I will have to give that to him.
I think both of them would probably agree with that. And, you know, I took like the business track after doing engineering for a while. So this was kind of the natural order for us.
It was like the natural dynamic that happens when you're kids.
Yeah. And certainly like we fought and argued a lot as kids, but we also had similar interests in, you know, really nerdy stuff, sci-fi, rockets, Legos, robotics, all that kind of thing.
I still love Legos.
I'm with you. Yeah. And, you know, when we were kids, we made phone games together. We
phone
launched
games. Oh, like iPhone games? Really? Yeah. You guys like coded phone games? That's really cool.
So we had some like natural hobby level, like working together on projects.
Oh, that's
right?
Cool.
And then we did overlap some in our actual work at SpaceX. You know, when I would be doing a bigger government proposal, I would sometimes end up needing one of Ryan input. Or Kirby to give input from the relevant engineering organization. So that was pretty fun.
That's really cool.
And yeah, we, you know, all had this passion for space and really for helping expand humanity's presence beyond Earth, and came together with this idea.
That's amazing. I remember when you first told me about the idea, you're like, I can't tell you what it is, but I'll tell you, Ryan just burned down his garage trying to build it. And I was like, that's so cool. And Ryan's married. And I was like, is he still married? And he's and you're like, yes. And I'm like, that's an even better signal.
Thankfully, the garage burning down actually worked out well for them.
Tell us about
that. Their house is redone now. So yeah, Ryan could tell this story better than I, but let's say he was doing some engineering activities and some unrelated non-engineering activities. The garage ended up burning down, smoking out the house. They spent 2 years rebuilding the house.
So he was building his prototype in the garage.
Maybe, maybe not.
And that's insane. Was he there when it burnt down, or did he just show up and his house is like gone?
They got a text from the neighbor saying like, oh, yay, your garage is on fire. You should come home.
That's insane. Hopefully the company doesn't, that was the only time that we'll have to put out a fire.
Yes. Yes. And thankfully now, you know, operating with water as our propellant, it's quite safe. The worst that happens is, you know, you spill some fuel and something's wet and you clean it up with a paper towel.
You won't have that problem on the moon because there's no air.
Indeed.
Tell us about, I find it super interesting, probably the numbers you were dealing with in government and the numbers you were dealing with at SpaceX in terms of contracts and like the figures. It probably didn't faze you as much. And now that you're running your own company, it's much probably lower numbers.
Yeah.
But what is the impact on the psyche that you have when you're dealing with like hiring people and people depend on you as a CEO, as a founder, you and your brothers? What's that like? Put it in perspective.
That's a super interesting question. I think about that a decent amount. The smallest contract, you know, that I was dealing with at SpaceX was enormous relative to what we're dealing with now,
like hundreds
right?
of millions.
and coming and running a startup, like bringing it from zero, you know, winning a $150,000 SBIR like feels as exciting to
you
me.
You guys are
as,
like so
a
happy.
$70 million contract did then, right?
Yeah.
Certainly there is more pressure and, you know, the context is kind of jarring when I think about the two things in comparison, like the numbers that we were doing then and that I was personally doing in that role versus what I'm doing now. And the level of effort is not really different, right? To get that tiny contract now versus the big contract then. So it is kind of strange. We've been doing it almost 2 years now, so I'm like a little bit acclimated.
Yeah.
But it's still super exciting, you know, every little win we get as a startup.
And then hiring, it must be super important because as a small company, you guys start with the three of you.
Yep.
And now you've scaled to how many?
13 now.
13. And you're looking to hire more?
Yep, absolutely.
And so having choosing people that you want to work with for the long term and giving them a piece of your business.
Yep.
Must be a harder decision than just adding someone to a bigger team that you had before. Tell us about that. Like, what's your experience been in hiring, building up your team, and what are you looking for in a new team member?
Yeah, certainly it's a different experience as a startup, you know, doing much of this ourselves and being personally responsible for all parts of that process. Definitely, we were also very selective about hiring to our teams at SpaceX tried to keep things tight.
Of course.
You know, every person had to be bringing something unique and valuable and fit with the team. So that part, I think we had good experience doing already. But you're right. You know, we are giving people a piece of the company. We're really bringing them in to like be a core member of this starting early team now.
Yeah.
And any bad hire has a bad impact on the company at this stage. So, and a great hire has a huge positive impact, right?
Of course.
High variance, and we're also out there, you know, sourcing and recruiting. That's a constant thing every day. And we don't have, you know, the resources of a big company to help us do that.
Not yet.
Not yet. Right. But it is fun, you know, getting to meet these people from different companies, trying to sell them on our company, getting people really to buy into the vision and then come and immediately make a big impact. And everyone's wearing different hats, right? They're not just slotted into like, I'm building this component. They're making an impact on the whole company.
They're thinking
and the trajectory
out loud on the vision. I always think, and for me personally, when Type 1 was started, I had a little bit of the vision, right?
Yeah.
And you hold up that torch and other people see it.
Yeah.
And they come and they add a piece of their vision to that vision, and that torch grows into a fire, a bonfire, yeah, and then a garage fire.
Yeah. ideally only once for that part.
I mean, well, yeah.
Yeah.
And so talk to us about what you're looking to hire for in the coming month, 2 months, 3 months, and so on. So maybe anybody viewing would be open to applying any of the open roles at Argo.
Really all engineering disciplines still. Everyone we've hired has been on the engineering side, and some of that is pretty competitive, right? Every space startup needs avionics folks, software folks, et cetera. So we're competing with a lot of different companies for these things. But the thing that's really sometimes difficult to find is somebody who has not just done a narrow piece of a problem, a narrow piece of engineering, but has actually built something, flown something, you know, seen some system level stuff, but also gone deep on their specific area of expertise.
Okay.
So right now, big focus for us on flight software hiring.
Flight software.
And on avionics hiring. You know,
okay,
we're pretty, we have some of every discipline, you know, mechanical, GNC, software, et cetera. But those are the big focus areas right now.
Great. So if you want to work on a lunar company that, and you're an avionics person and a flight software expert, call Robert.
Please, yes.
Talk to me about you on a personal level. Like, what do you like to do in your spare time?
Yeah.
How do you like cool off from like the stresses of running a company?
I don't think I've quite figured that out yet.
Same.
But I do have two young daughters, so
congratulations.
Thank you. Company and kids and
honestly, that's your biggest achievement.
Yeah, no doubt.
It will continue to be for the rest of your life. Even if you get to the moon and you find water, that's beautiful.
That's true. That's true. You know, in theory, I do have some hobbies that I used to do. So someday we'll get back to that.
What are those, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. You know, working out, skiing, golf.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. This year I've been, I guess for the longest time in my 20s, I thought what would make me fulfilled was work and success and money and, you know, those external achievements. And I was like, I'll be happy after that. Like, you'll find the fulfillment after that. And that's just a piece of the puzzle. And then I realized this year, I was like, what do I like to do myself without like external validation, or just if I was alone on an island, what would I want to be doing? And I picked up a lot of different hobbies, and I found enjoyment in a lot of those things. Like, started flying planes and I started, boxing, and I started yoga and doing all these different things. And it makes you better as a leader when you're able to disconnect from the day-to-day. Like, you're always on phone calls or text or emails. Finding time to actually disconnect and reconnect with yourself when you come back into it is super important. And I've been like exploring that whole aspect of it. What do your parents think of you guys starting a company together?
I think they're excited. You know, neither of them was...
It's like a single risk for the family. Yeah. It's like, guys, like, can we spread out the risk a little bit?
Right, right. That was kind of the case when we all three ended up at SpaceX, too. So they're used to that part. But neither of them were engineers. You know, neither of them were in the space business. They had other different jobs. But, yeah, they're excited. You know, I think they have... When we started it, some worry about like, oh, man, you guys are really going to go do this together, right? And some of the, wow, this startup thing sounds a little bit crazy. Like, can you do a, you know, less high risk venture maybe? But no, we wanted to go, you know, all in, go space.
Do they understand the business?
Yes. Okay. Yes, definitely.
At least they understand. My mom still doesn't even know what I do. She's like, space? What is this space?
Yeah. I think we've been talking to both of them about space things for enough decades now that it makes sense.
That's cool. Yeah. No, that's super exciting. How old are your daughters?
4 and 1.
Okay, so they don't quite understand that much, but they probably have that space bug already, like, in them.
My 4-year-old has asked multiple times, like, did Dad go to space?
Well, you know, by the time they're our age, imagine what that world is going to look like.
It's going to be awesome.
You know, if you're growing up today, when you're 18, 20, 30, mm-hmm. There's going to be a million people on Mars, maybe 100,000, 100 even.
Yeah.
What do you think that future looks like? Yeah. Like, let's go long term. What does 2050 look like?
Yeah, 2050, hard for me to even imagine what that's like. But as a baseline, in space terms, I think absolutely we've got regular daily transportation off of Earth that we don't even view as interesting, really. It's like airplane flights, you know, taking off from LAX every few minutes.
Okay.
We've got human presence on Mars.
Do we solve the LAX traffic problem?
Probably not. Probably compounded.
Okay, so daily flights to space.
Yeah, and it's just routine. You know, like, people live in space, in stations, on Mars, on the Moon. If we're talking 2050, right? Mm-hmm. I think that is just
that's for sure.
Real sci-fi stuff is just commonplace at that point. And we're trying to expand further out into the solar system.
What is the benefit to Earth of space? Like, if we talk about all of this stuff and somebody that doesn't know the space industry and it's like, oh, well, so wasteful. Like, what do you think the benefit, in your own words?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the very near term, there's the basic commercial stuff that we and some other companies are trying to do, right? We're saying, let's go use propellant from the Moon instead of having to launch it from Earth.
Okay.
That means we can use more of a rocket's payload for useful things, you know, things that you need to build. Other companies are looking at manufacturing on orbit, generating power on orbit. There are ways that are commercial facing near-term applications for space, right? And today already, right, Starlink and other constellations.
I was on a JSX flight yesterday, and like, people are calling me on video call, and whoa, this is crazy.
Right, yeah, and that benefits Earth today, and it's also, you know, providing connectivity where none exists today, not just providing more, you know, convenience to me and you.
Yeah.
So that's a use of space that exists today that is helping Earth, and we can help that. There's other people starting to look at what can we manufacture in orbit that we can't manufacture on Earth.
You know, so like heavy industry.
Yeah. And in the near term, small things, small high-value things, new types of drugs, new types of fiber. But in the long term, yeah, heavy industry. You know, that's the Blue Origin view, right? Put heavy industry in orbit, put a bunch of people in orbit, take that stuff off of Earth.
Less pollution.
Yeah. And in our view, you know, get resources from space, use resources from the Moon. Other people are looking at, can we use helium-3 on the Moon and make, you know, quantum computing and other things.
What is
helium-3?
Fusion
reaction. So it's something that is hard to get on Earth. It's often the main way that is gotten on Earth is a byproduct of nuclear weapons production and nuclear reactors. So some people are looking at, can we get this off of the Moon since it's so rare on Earth and use
it? It's an element, right?
Yeah.
You read about that a lot in the space books, like two of the main elements or things that you can find on the lunar surface. One, helium-3, and water. I think water is the nearer term and the bigger market. But helium-3 definitely has some very specific use cases that it's hard to find on Earth.
Yep.
And it's actually more abundant on the Moon than the Earth, so that's super interesting.
Yeah. And the other thing, though, like, going beyond the practical commercial aspects of using space is I think humanity just needs a frontier, right? We thrive on exploration and pushing outward.
Yeah.
And that is space, like, now.
The U.S. was built on Manifest Destiny. Yeah. At least there's no natives on the moon.
Correct.
That we know of.
Only rocks and dust.
Yes. But no, that is super interesting. And I was reading a book about by Robert Zubrin about what is going to be the biggest export from the lunar surface mm-hmm. or from Mars. And it's going to be innovation mm-hmm. because frontiers drive people looking for opportunity.
Yeah.
And that drives creative need for innovation to survive. Mm-hmm. And then that innovation can be exported back to Earth and make life sure. better here on Earth.
Yep.
Like think about there's people on Mars. How are they going to make food? How are they going to, you know, begin the 100-year terraforming process?
Yep.
And if we can terraform Mars, like conceivably we can make our planet here on Earth better.
Yep.
So that drive for innovation, that expansion and the frontier brings
yeah.
is going to be very important for Earth. And I'm super excited to see that in my lifetime.
For sure.
Thanks to your work at SpaceX and all the bright people around Elon that have made that come to fruition in the whole industry. Do you think there's going to be some value in the convergence of robotics and AI and all these other innovations that are happening in, you know, adjacent industries to space and how that's going to drive space forward?
Yeah, definitely. You know, AI today, I'm kind of skeptical. I don't think, you know, LLMs are really true AI. To me, real AI.
They're a step there.
Yeah, they're a step there. But I think real AI has to be able to extrapolate, not just interpolate, and has to be able to take fundamental laws and come up with new things out of them. But autonomy, you know, edge computing, machine learning, and eventually AI do have great applications for space. You know, as we get bigger constellations in low Earth orbit, more autonomy for the spacecraft is needed as they automatically maneuver and avoid collisions. And, you know, you don't want to have thousands of operators on these things. And then as we push further out into space, right, into geosynchronous orbit, into cislunar space, the latency becomes a problem. So you need to have more automation on the spacecraft so it can act without mm-hmm. direction from a human operator on Earth. And the further out we go, the more important that is. You know, surface of the moon, surface of Mars, that's critical.
Yeah, we invested in a company that is doing component design with machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so how I understood it, when you build, say, a thermal component, you use memory of how it should be designed, and you mm-hmm. design it, and then you test it, and then you reiterate. And so if you use AI or machine learning, and you say, you give it instructions of, I want to build a component that looks like this and does this purpose and is, you know, for thermal.
Yeah.
It will give you a product design output that, and then the iterative process is a lot quicker,
yep.
which brings down your cost, which makes your product more efficient. So that's super interesting to see those early convergences happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope we see an explosion of innovation there.
Yeah, and I think that, like, the design process being enhanced, you know, physical design, not just software design or code, will be an awesome one, especially as we get into things that are being launched to space that are not traditional satellites, mm-hmm. you know, things that look more like what we do terrestrially with infrastructure, you know, parts, cranes, cell towers, cables, things that get constructed in space. The sort of generative design, the AI and ML-assisted design will be super interesting for that.
Do you think humanoid robots will play a role in the lunar economy?
Maybe. You know, I don't know about humanoid versus other sort of purpose-built robots, but certainly, you know, more advanced robotics will be important for that, yeah.
Okay, so fun question.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the asteroid Apophis?
Vaguely, yes.
You know that it has, like, a super close, like, trajectory to Earth in 2028?
Yep.
NASA says there's no risk for a collision, but it's coming closer to us than the moon is to us.
Yep.
I would Argo be able to save the world if you, because you move things in space. If it,
yep.
if we found out that it was going to come and Armageddon was going to happen and we're all going to die, could we have an Argo life-saving mission?
You know, if somebody wants to go full Armageddon and give us some nuclear devices to go plant on there, space cowboy style, we're totally down for that.
I'll sign up. I'll be a space cowboy.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, that's not cool that we could almost die, but
we won't.
But we have the ability to save it today.
Yeah.
The DART mission that NASA did, where they
DART
collided.
Was awesome, yeah,
it was super cool to see that happen. What are your favorite sci-fi books?
Oh, man. So original Dune, I've read that many times over the decades. That's definitely one of them. Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars series.
Okay.
And then I kind of like some of the apocalyptic sci-fi. I don't know if you've ever read A Canticle for Leibowitz. That's one of my favorites.
I'll have to yeah. read that one. My favorite is We Are Legion, We Are Bob. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
It's a 4-book series. The fifth one's coming out soon.
Yeah.
It's about this guy who started a company in 2010, 2012. He sold his company.
Yeah.
And he made a bunch of money. And the first thing he did is he bought he freezes his body in mm-hmm. case he dies. So he dies, and then 100 years goes by, and he gets uploaded to a computer when he gets revived, and he becomes a satellite, and he's a von Neumann probe, and he goes explores the cool. the galaxy, and he makes copies of himself, yeah. and all the copies are different, and they terraform and meet like aliens on new planets and become God, and
Love it.
Super cool.
I'll check it out.
But no, Robert, it's been a pleasure having you on today. I'm excited to see the progress and the continued success that Argo will have. You've just announced a round of financing. We were happy to be involved, and yep, we're super excited to see what you do with the new funds, and hopefully get to the lunar surface soon, mine some water,
absolutely,
move some satellites around,
yeah,
maybe save the world. So we're really excited to be in your orbit and your circle. So thank you for being here. And look forward to continuing to work with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you.